Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Would you like to become the headline sponsor of the most authoritative Leeds podcast on the planet? Would you like to be front and centre on the Phil Hay Show alongside Phil and the Square Ball Team? Would you like to reach hundreds of thousands of highly engaged Leeds fans every month? Of course you would. But your brand can advertise with us now. Our skilled and charming commercial team are waiting to hear from you. Contact partnerships@theathletic.com. That's partnerships@theathletic.com.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hay Show.
Hello there. Welcome to The Phil Hay Show, brought to you by The Athletic, along with The Square Ball. Dan here from The Square Ball. Phil Hay, of course, here from The Athletic, who you'll hear from in just a second or two. A reminder that if you want to read the aftermath of the Chelsea game, theathletic.com/Leeds pod to sign up for The Athletic and read what Phil had to say. You can also go back and read the pre-game and post-game interactions with Phil, who's been chatting to fans on there as well. And Phil, back from Stamford Bridge, empty-handed, and the lead-off on your match report, your analysis on this, is related to the lack of goals in this Leeds side that we've seen in recent weeks.
It is goals, isn't it? That was what was being discussed after the Fulham game on Tuesday, the FA Cup game. And I think because of the nature of that match and because it was the FA Cup, everybody was able to look at the finishing in a slightly more abstract way and almost to laugh at the fact that towards the end it felt as if nothing was going to go in from a yard out. But obviously the risk and the danger is very, very real in the Premier League at the moment. And it jumped out even more on Saturday, I think. Not just there were chances at Stamford Bridge, but it was a kind of small number of them. And it's more, I think, now the bigger picture of what's been going on with the goal scoring since the turn of the year and since the end of the World Cup break. It's peculiar, really, because up until that point, when you analyse Jesse Marsh's team and the numbers behind the results, the numbers behind the form, goal scoring was never a huge issue. They were outscoring pretty comfortably the sides at the bottom of the league, sides around them in the table. And more and more, as time went on, the concern was about the defence that was conceding two goals a game and was really struggling to shore itself up. And because of Marsh's tactics and the way he was approaching it, didn't really show any sign of shoring itself up. But if you look at the stats now, it's 7 league goals in 11 games since the turn of the year, since the season restarted after the end of the World Cup. And that's a really problematic number. The reality in these sort of situations is that wins are what get you out of trouble, or wins are what get you out of trouble in good time and get you out of trouble with games to spare, space to spare, you know, a little bit of breathing space towards the end of the season. When Javier Gracia was talking after the defeat at Chelsea, he was saying, we need to score more. If we're going to get more victories, we've got to have more goals in the team. But if goals aren't coming, we have to be compact, we have to be solid, we have to be defensively tight. And I think, to be fair to him, over the past 2 weeks, being compact and being solid is something he's done pretty well with this team. I know they've lost to Chelsea. I know they lost at Fulham in midweek, but they aren't giving away swathes of big chances. They aren't massively porous. They do look pretty organised and they do look like they know what they're doing at the back. But what he'll know himself, and I think we all know, that if it carries on like this and if goals are a problem, this is going to be a struggle right to the very end. And in terms of survival and staying up, it's going to be skinny your teeth stuff. They do have to start scoring more. They need to find goals from various players in this team. And it has been the case that more recently they haven't been coming.
It's interesting to note, isn't it, that I remember you writing about Leeds potentially being able to score their way out of trouble. I think it was around the turn of the year, maybe after Christmas, and it's proved not to be the case. Do you think that's down to the injury to Rodrigo predominantly, or is there sort of a bigger thing at play here?
That's definitely part of it. I've written on him for tomorrow about, it's kind of multifaceted, the story around Rodrigo. You know, a player who for so long seemed out of place here, you know, didn't really seem at home, almost trying to make him into a player that he wasn't, you know, used so often at 10, particularly by Marcelo Bielsa, and also coming from a side, Valencia, who just did not press, you know, were very low on that scale, to a side who pressed more than any other in the Premier League and more than the most sides in Europe. It was a difficult transition for him. And, you know, oddly enough, he probably goes down as one of the success stories from the Marsh train, Rodrigo. I think he had his best run and his best form while Marsh was head coach. And I don't doubt at all that part of that was the decision to move him to nine, you know, to play him as a centre forward and play him up front. And in no way is Rodrigo an archetypal English centre forward, but it seems to me that nine is his best position. And I think that's been borne out in his finishing, his goal scoring, and just his general threat levels this season, which have been good. You know, they match up to a lot of top strikers, considering the number of minutes he's actually been able to play. And yes, he's been missed, without a doubt. And it does look ever more, the appearance at Accrington off the bench when Leeds were 3-0 up, like a risk that didn't need to be taken. But I do accept that that's an easy stick to beat a head coach with. You know, there are a lot of circumstances like that where somebody will get played, where a player like Rodrigo will feature towards the end. There's no issue, there's no problem, and everybody moves on. But it's not purely him. I mean, I look at Jorginho Rutter, and I think there's definite talent there. There's a definite player there. But he is going through a teething process at the moment. He's moved from league to league. He's young. The goals aren't flowing for him. And I found myself thinking post-match about the number of times now that we've sat and listened to a head coach, different head coaches in different seasons, talking about the kind of hope that Patrick Bamford will be back from injury next week. You know, that just seems to have been a cycle that Leeds have been going through for so long now. And since he was scoring in that first Premier League season, 2021, they just haven't had a kind of uber-reliable number nine, have they? Uber-reliable centre-forward. Rodrigo was almost it for a while this season, but Rodrigo's been injured, you know, missing for the best part of 2 months. They don't have that regular goal scorer. And actually, if you go back to, you know, 2018 when Bielsa first came in, they haven't been a club who have looked for 20-goal strikers or depended on 20-goal strikers at any stage in that period. There aren't even that many players who've been in double figures, you know, season to season from 2018 onwards. But they need goals now. And you do have that question in your head of who in the squad is going to put the hand up. And I still almost feel that a return in Rodrigo might be the best answer to that.
Do we know how far away he is at the moment, Phil?
He was hopeful of being fit on this side of the international break. So I think was kind of optimistically crossing his fingers for Brighton this weekend, hoping definitely that he might be back in the picture, back in the squad for Wolves the weekend after. You do find that players tend to hope that they will be back sooner than perhaps the medics think they will be. They tend to be more optimistic on that front. And they'll be cautious with him and careful with him, because it was a broken tibia, fractured tibia, not something you can rush ahead of schedule if you shouldn't. But, you know, he will want to be back in the mix. And without a doubt, Gracia will want him back in the mix too.
Just on tibia problems, do we know anything of Stuart Dallas just yet? Because there was hope he'd be back on the grass after Christmas. We're obviously well past Christmas now. We're into March. Any signs of him returning this season at all? Or is it basically a write-off this year?
I don't think I can't say at this stage that the entire season is a write-off, but I know that from the point where he was injured at the end, towards the end of last season, and fractured his femur, you know, nasty injury, really rare injury, actually, in football as well. The feeling was that he would be happy if he got himself back before the end of this season. And I don't think that was a case of saying that it was unlikely to happen. I just think he wasn't trying to set himself the time scale of being back for Christmas or being back for, you know, the turn of the year, second half of the season. I think if he got games in before this season finished, then that would be pretty satisfying, and that would be him on target, considering how bad the injury was. I mean, Grassi is giving very little away about injuries at the moment, and I haven't had an update recently on Dallas. He seems to be on schedule and he seems to be doing well. You remember Marsh saying he had a little cleanup operation, or a what Marsh called a minor procedure, not so long ago, but I think that was standard and I think that was part of the process. But it was never really the expectation that Dallas was going to play a huge part this year.
Just returning to Chelsea and the lack of goals and all that, we still did have chances in that game, particularly in that second half. I remarked on our post-match podcast, The Match Ball, that most of my notes towards the back end, we had chances in that game.
Yeah, I felt like, well, some people were making the point afterwards that the best of them was Melies in injury time, and perhaps that told the story itself about where Leeds are at. It was a good opportunity, that, actually. And in many ways, something, you know, a header like that, you'd have liked a centre-back with a crunching finish to have knocked that in, or a natural goal scorer. But that was your sort of desperate Hail Mary stuff in injury time. And there probably is no keeper, actually, who goes up more than Melies when those moments arise. And it's quite funny because I was thinking of Unai Emery's criticism of Emi Martinez against Arsenal recently, going up for a late Villa corner and then getting caught on the counter for Arsenal to make it 4-2, and him saying, you know, it very rarely happens that the goalkeeper scores, very rarely has an impact. But on the one hand, it's entertaining that to see a keeper go up. And on the other, it just causes that little bit of extra chaos. And in that instance on Saturday, it almost worked. But beyond that, the chance of note, really, the moment was Ruter from close range. And he was unlucky because the block that denied that, I don't think Badiashile knew a huge amount about where the ball was going or where it was. He was just there and happened to be in a good position to block it. I mean, good defending in that sense that he was on hand. But I think probably 9 times out of 10, that finishes in the back of the net. So yeah, there were chances, not a flood of them, but probably as many as we would have expected away at Stamford Bridge. I think the thing about Chelsea is that clearly they're not in a particularly great place. And even afterwards, there were questions being aimed at Potter about, was he too defensive from 1-0 onwards? You know, is it really working? Are there still problems that need to be addressed? But I think if you look at it in context, they have an awful lot of good players there, and they have the sort of players who can win them games. I thought the midfield two of Fernandes and Kovacic had the better of Leeds midfield for certainly the first half hour and then the early part of the second half where they scored. But in the end, you know, it was kind of set piece hell, wasn't it? Some outswinging corner in, rising header from Fofana. Kind of feel like that sort of instance should be quite easy to defend. So although Leeds could have had something from the game, and I think they were in a position to take something from it, I'm a bit like you. I never really felt like it was coming. I never really felt like they were actually going to get anything out of it. But I still feel deep down like that sort of game is probably not the type of fixture that's going to keep Leeds up this season. There are others that are going to be more critical.
Yeah, we did speak in the run-up to this about perhaps with Gracia in position now, that would the results sort of, I guess, regress to the mean almost, like the games that you don't expect to get anything from, such as this one, you probably won't, and yet the chances may lie in other games. And you look at some of the fixtures that are coming up, Elland Road, we've got Leicester, Palace, Forest yet to come. I mean, the number of games is shrinking and they are becoming more and more important with every passing week, but they are the games you identify, don't you, that you think, well, that's one where we should be or could be getting something from it.
Yeah, I think the concern when you get to this stage of the season and you're still where Leeds are, i.e. 17th, is that games start to become must-win. You know, you start to boil down to the number of matches where actually you've got to take points from them. Otherwise, you're just not going to get out of it. And they're not too far away from that, Leeds, albeit with a little bit of room to spare still, and not in the bottom three as it stands. But there are going to come fixtures very, very shortly that they've got to take something from. I quite like what Grassi has done with the team so far defensively. I know there was the issue on Saturday of them getting overloaded constantly on the left, but you know, Chelsea almost ran out of steam after half an hour. The last 15 minutes of the first half were much better. And also, it was a little bit tighter in that area once Somerville started to drop in more and to help Ayling. Ayling had this issue of not quite knowing, because of the system Graham Potter had picked and the way they set up, of not quite knowing whether to gravitate towards Chilwell on the right, or whether to to stick on somebody like Felix or Havertz. I was looking at the average positions at halftime, and all three of them were kind of drifting over to the left-hand side or Chelsea's left to create overloads and to give Ayling a problem. But Leeds did tighten up there. And I do feel like they are looking like a solid side under Gracia, you know, defensively and in that part of the pitch. They're looking pretty organised. But, to come back to that same point of conversation, they need to start winning games. And whereas at the start of a season, you know, this would be how you'd feel your way in gently, and you start by being solid at the back and you look for chances as time goes on and you try to become more creative, he is going to have to find a way of delivering better results pretty quickly.
You say Leeds are a solid side. I do wonder sometimes if we might be a little bit lightweight. Well, I mean, what do you think to that? The sort of a mixture of youth, inexperience in their players in transitional phases between leagues, perhaps a lack of physicality in the side. Is that fair or not?
Yeah, no, I think it probably is. I think you could also ask the question of how many of these players have experienced this sort of situation before and are absolutely tailor-made for it. It's very different being in a season where, as was the case under Bielsa first time around in the Premier League, you're kind of out of the picture to go down for most of it. And cruising would be unfair because Leeds never cruised under Bielsa, but you look as if you're making it easy. You know, you look as if the Premier League's no problem for you. There's a big difference between that and being in a scenario where you've won five times all season and you can't seem to get yourself away from the bottom three. I mean, I don't imagine looking around that there are other clubs who don't have that problem too, but I wouldn't have said that this is a squad or a team particularly, I think looking at the starting lineup, that's awash with experienced campaigners of dealing with this kind of fraught term where it just feels as if right from the outset you've been battling this. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I do feel like, to compare the midfields on Saturday, I did feel like Fernandes and Kovacic dominated it in the periods where it needed to be dominated. But then again, with Fernandes, you're talking about a player who's cost in excess of £100 million, so he should.
You and I have been chatting on WhatsApp away from this podcast, and we've reached that point of saying this is a season that just needs to die again, haven't we? Which is a bit of a shame that we're here again, second season on the bounce.
Well, particularly now that the FA Cup's gone. And I mean, I don't know how much you can afford to be diverted by the FA Cup in a season like this. It just felt like a bit of an opportunity missed at Fulham and a bit of an opportunity missed to have a bit of fun with the back end of this season. It definitely does need to die in the sense that it's another one that Leeds are going to want to move on from pretty quickly. But as we always say, they're going to have to make sure that they're moving on from it with Premier League status assured and a 17th place or better secured in the weeks ahead. It's there to be done. And, you know, the two of us chat constantly about this, about what seems to be a wildly even field from about 9th or 10th place downwards. You could really make an argument to watch any of those sides on any given weekend. You could make an argument for any of them being in the bottom three. You could make an argument for any of them being a little bit more comfortable up in 13th, 14th, 12th position, whatever it is, because there isn't a huge amount between any of them. And I think that is what's making the bottom of the table so difficult to call. You know, I keep thinking that Southampton and Bournemouth are going to slip away, but then Bournemouth very nearly beat Arsenal, very nearly take something from Arsenal. Southampton win against Leicester, and it all closes up again. Everton just about beat Forest, but get pegged back. But that leaves Leeds outside the bottom three on goal difference alone. I think that, again, is what reinforces the point. If you're winning games, you will open up space over these clubs. If you're not, you're going to be stuck there right to the end.
Just looking, everyone from 12th down in the table, so this is Crystal Palace downwards as the table stands at the minute. In the last two round of fixtures, there have been four victories between all those sides. It's barely anything, isn't it? That's what, 16 games out of 16 possible victorious outcomes. And some teams will have been playing each other, obviously, and they can't both win. But even still, it just goes to show how valuable a win is in the bottom half of the table.
Well, yeah, and virtually nobody winning games back-to-back, but Villa have now. And suddenly, I'm looking at Villa on 34 points. They're 12 points clear of Everton with a considerably better goal difference too. And you feel like Villa are as good as safe, and they probably are. They'll still need a few more points, but they're going to get them in the 13 games that they've got left. So that's what makes the difference. I think we've touched on this previously, that it's a difficult division to get on a roll in the Premier League if you're not a particularly strong side in it or not a particularly good side. because even to look at, you know, the games coming up for Leeds, Brighton at home would be extremely difficult. They've had a good year. And then you go to Wolves that you hopefully fancy taking something from. You've got Forest and Palace at home again, back to back in a few days. They're going to be so important, those. But it's always interspersed with Arsenal away, Liverpool at home, you know, Man City away. The last month of the season doesn't look like a good one for Leeds. So it isn't easy to suddenly get yourself into a run of 6-7 games without defeat. But it is possible to put together, you know, like Villa have done, back-to-back victories. And I think looking at Forest and Palace, we've said this a few times this season, but that probably is a little juncture that's going to dictate quite a lot.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Any positives we can take from Chelsea then, Phil?
First of all, they were very much in that game. And I think Chelsea would have felt aggrieved if Leeds had dug out a draw in the end. But I don't think Leeds were never in touch and never in contention. They had to bail a lot of water in the first half hour. That much is clear. And you had Joao Felix hitting the crossbar. You had the save from Havertz that Melier made. You know, they could have been further in front. But I think one of the reassuring things was the way Leeds were able to turn the tide from that point onwards and to take the sting out of Chelsea's performance and then to start having a go themselves. And as we said in part one, it didn't feel as if they were going to cut through Chelsea at will. But they were causing Chelsea problems and they were putting the pressure on. And I don't doubt that the circumstances down there helped with that. I started to notice, really, the grumbling start coming from the home end. Not much of it, has to be said. The crowd were pretty supportive as a whole. But you could just feel a little bit of dissatisfaction with backwards passes. You know, every now and again, Chelsea having opportunities to attack and then regressing a touch. Just that, as we've seen at Elland Road and as we recognise, you know, just that little bit of grumbling that makes you think, I wonder if this is about to turn. And then, of course, Fofana bangs in that header and, you know, everything changes and suddenly Chelsea realise that they're on for a win. But I think, again, obviously, structurally, it was a challenge with Chilwell down the left to begin with. And it was something that Gracia had to address. But I feel as if, you know, certainly defensively and structurally, I feel as if the players are taking on the ideas that he's trying to give them. And they are playing with more width, absolutely no doubt about that. And I think that will help. I think with somebody like Rodrigo returning, he'll probably feed quite well off what they're doing. The final ball absolutely needs to be better. That was probably a bigger problem than the finishing at Chelsea, was that the good positions they were taking up weren't really leading to good enough service from either side. And had it been better, I think they would have put more pressure on Chelsea. But in no way would I put it down as a poor performance. I just don't think it was good enough to deliver anything.
With regards to Rodrigo, I do get the sense that perhaps this style might suit him as well, in the sense that it's not the out-and-out pressing that perhaps he struggled with previously. Like, it clearly didn't work, did it, under Bielsa, the relentless running around. And it seemed to me that he was pressing far less under Jesse Marsh. I mean, whether he was following instructions there or not, we don't know. But perhaps he's been able to turn his energies and his attentions to just putting the goals in. So I do tend to agree that him being back in this side could make the difference for Leeds in the coming weeks.
In plain sight, he always looked to me like one of the least naturally effective pressers. It didn't seem to be his game. And I think also in the system that Marsh was playing, you felt as if Rodrigo was looking constantly for those balls through the middle, you know, the through balls that let him run off one centre-back. And because of the kind of congestion in the central areas, because of the reliance on transition, those kind of passes didn't come consistently enough to him. But in saying that, he's got 10 goals this season. And we were digging through the numbers. You know, you tend to get 3 to 4 shots on goal per 90 from him, which is right up with, the most prolific prolific producers of shots in the Premier League, Haaland and Nunes and Gabriel Jesus, Mitrovic too. And he is sort of comfortably outperforming his expected goals. He's actually done that in every season that he's been at Leeds, despite the fact that the first two certainly didn't go as well for him individually as this one has. But he's doing it to an even stronger degree this time round. And I think, you know, I was saying in the piece I've written that for a long time, you found yourself thinking if that old cliche of if Rodrigo's the answer, what's the question? But actually, I think at this stage, when it comes to goal scoring, he might well be the answer. And I think he clearly doesn't mind scenarios where he's trying to run onto through balls, you know, balls from the middle that give him that opportunity, like at Spurs, you know, where he can get onto it, shoot across the keeper and score. But I think as well, he's a decent poacher or decent at looking for balls coming in from the flanks. And again, four shots in the six-yard box from him, four goals. He's been clinical at close range. And I just feel at the moment, again, Bamford might well be back for Brighton, but he is just stuck in that in-and-out cycle of niggles or concerns constantly. It just feels like if you're looking for a banker up front at the moment, Rodrigo's probably as close to it as anyone.
Goal threat has been coming from Willian Onta recently. What do you make of the decision to leave him out of this one then?
I think I understand the rationale that Nonto is 19, he's in his first season in the Premier League. He's surprised all of us, I think. And I suspect that when push comes to shove, he might end up being very firmly in contention for the Player of the Year award at Leeds. But I understand the rationale of not wanting to just rely on him religiously and not want to just push him and push him and push him and push him. You know, there has to be weight put on other players as well. And I think it's common sense that from time to time he'll need to come out of the team. And it sort of makes me think with Gracia that I like the fact that he has the conviction and the confidence to be able to rest the player or drop the player that everybody, me included, would pick in the starting lineup. But Nonto, similarly, is going to be somebody that they're going to need some output from before the end of the season. I think what I've noticed with him, and I guess the issue for him, is that it does seem as if after that, you know, that period where he just could do no wrong and was having such a big impact in games, it does seem as if analysts and managers across the league have applied a clear eye to that and have said, this is somebody that we need to keep a handle on. This is somebody that we need to negate, that we need to double up on, whatever it is that we do to stop him having the freedom of the pitch. And I think he's not had the same freedom to play in the last few weeks that he was having previously.
Yeah, I was going to say, you could see it with your own eyes, couldn't you, that he was getting doubled up on everywhere that he went.
Yeah.
So I guess it's a case of switching the focus elsewhere on the pitch, then, isn't it, and asking other players to step up. What have you made of Jack Harrison's form then, with that in mind?
It's not great, is it? It's not great. I don't think anybody would pretend that it is. Harrison tends to blow hot and cold, and he tends to go through periods where it isn't working for him, but always has that thing in his game where there are assists there, occasionally there are goals, where he will contribute something that makes a difference. I think what I'm not prepared to do with Harrison is to accept that what went on at the end of January had no impact on him at all. I mean, I don't know to what extent it has affected him, whether it has. You know, I don't know what difference it's made. I don't know where he is mentally. They're still talking about a new contract for him. Leeds are still hopeful that they can get that done. But I don't think you can disregard the effect of being at another club's training ground on deadline day and being in the mindset that you're about to be sold, even though, as seems perfectly apparent, Harrison didn't want to go. You know, nobody should mistake the fact that he was at Leicester with him trying to force his way out. He was there because if he was told at the last minute that he was being sold, he had to be in position to get all the formalities done. And it seems to me that is going to have a psychological effect on a player. As I say, I can't say whether that is influencing his form at the moment, but no, he didn't have a good day on Saturday at all.
And what do you make of proceedings elsewhere this weekend then, results-wise in the Premier League? And the fact that it has remained so tight around the bottom, like you say, that bottom sort of seven or eight clubs, all bunched up within sort of 3, 4, 5 points of one another. Thinking specifically, first of all, about the Forest-Everton game, 2-2, ideal result for Leeds in many ways, that one, both teams dropping points.
Yeah, and I think even more important, Arsenal fighting back from 2-0 down. Someone said to me in the press box in the second half, it was just after Fofana had scored, somebody said Bournemouth are winning 2-0 at Arsenal, and you thought, yeah, of course they are.
Yeah.
Of course they are. But you still felt, because of what you'd seen from Bournemouth at Elland Road, and also because of what you'd seen from Arsenal at Villa and the way Arsenal have been all season, but specifically that Elland Road game, you did feel like there was probably fight back potential in that still. It's a little bit similar actually to Anfield and the absolute pace in that Manchester United took over there yesterday, that 7-0 defeat. I've kind of followed the coverage of Ten Hag's team this season, and they've been given a lot of credit, a lot of people thinking they're making a lot of progress, are developing into a really good side. I can only base this on the two games against Leeds, but they did not look like anything special in those two games at all. And I think, you know, that's similar with Bournemouth. 2-0 up at Arsenal, a lot of teams, a lot of circumstances, you'd think Arsenal are going to lose that. But because of what Bournemouth did against Leeds, you did think they'll be wobbly as this goes on. Arsenal get one goal, they'll start to cave in, which they absolutely did. And okay, the goal was extremely late, the winner. But even so, it's another game where O'Neill and his players haven't been able to manage their way through a situation where they've got 3 points almost on a plate for them. And I think you're right about Forest Everton. I think that was by far the best result. I think if you had to pick either side winning, it would have suited for Forest to win that game more than Everton. But given that Everton were 10 minutes or so away from moving out of the bottom three and sending Leeds back into the bottom three, that was good enough.
And we're within 3 points of Forest now, aren't we? So that means that, you know, in a very sort of basic sense, if we beat them when they come to Elland Road, then we should overtake them based on goal difference, you know, if that's the way it was to work. But it's just a reminder of how close this is, and that I think people, you know, far be it from me to tell you what to think here or feel, but it's not over yet and people don't need to panic just yet. Table's not great, but we've been here last season and we know what it feels like. It'll probably feel similar again this season, but it's not over yet.
Well, who from 12th down is really out of this? You know, Palace are on 27 points, so that gives them 5-point gap over Everton. But 27 isn't going to keep you up, and 27 isn't enough at this stage to feel like you're comfortable. It's only just beyond the point of game. And as you start to go down, you know, Leicester now on a run of three defeats back to back. There was chanting against Rodgers, from what I was told, during their game against Southampton at the weekend. And you're right about Forest. It's 4-point gap from Forest to 18th place. But they've gone through that process of 1 minute feeling like they're getting away from everybody, you know, and that it's coming good. And then suddenly starting to think again, are we going to get sucked back into this? And I think they will, without a doubt, have been the happier of the teams after the game against Everton yesterday. But this is absolutely wide open. And I mean, in terms of you saying there, it's not over. It's a million miles away from being over this. You know, the table is going to move constantly. It's going to change a great deal. But Leeds rapidly are moving into the period now where they're going to start running out of fixtures, where they're able to say, we need to take X amount from these games further down the line. They're going to start to hit games where on the day they've got to deliver results.
I mean, such is the nature of the Premier League, isn't it? When you say, yes, from 12th downwards are operating at just over a point per game. That is a low points total for a lot of teams, isn't it? And I remember back to the first season back, the Bielsa season in the Premier League, that even then, because we finished ninth, it wasn't until that late run came in the season that we started to feel comfortable. You know, looking back on it, you could probably guess that we were going to be all right, but that's only with the aid of hindsight. I remember at the time feeling like it wasn't particularly comfortable until quite late in that season, you know.
I have different recollections of that season. I remember Leeds losing to Brighton at home and getting knocked out of the FA Cup by Crawley. And I distinctly recall somebody tweeting me and saying, if we don't sign a centre-forward, we're going to be in big trouble in the second half of the season. And I read that and I thought, I don't feel like that at all. I feel like they'll be absolutely fine. They're winning enough games, they're scoring enough goals. It won't be that difficult to get themselves beyond the point where they're not going to drop out of the league. And bear in mind as well that that season, there were some sides who were having an absolute nightmare, particularly Sheffield United, who were so far adrift. But maybe time plays tricks, and maybe the state of this season and last season has made that first year under Bielsa feel more comfortable than it was for a long time. But it was just little things like going to West Brom and winning as emphatically as they did. You know, it just marked them out as a side who were going to have the legs to stay up and to do that comfortably. But it's been completely different last season and this season. And, you know, once again, it's far too close for comfort this year. And I was having this discussion on Twitter briefly with somebody yesterday who said, you know, I had written from time to time that actually Leeds have, give or take, the squad that they need. And I still feel like individually there are plenty of good players at Leeds. I don't feel like that's where they're falling down. they just haven't been built into a good team. They haven't been built into an effective and reliable team. And, you know, that's caught up with them at this stage of the season. It's very difficult to rectify that overnight. And, you know, as the weeks go by, you can't help but feel that however this plays out and wherever Leeds finish, it's going to be tight either way.
What makes a good team then? How do we bridge that gap? Is it possible to bridge that gap now? Does Gracia have the time available to him? Because you saw, again, your frame of reference is always Bielsa, isn't it, in recent years? You saw what he did over 6 to 8 weeks with the players in the summer ahead of Stoke in 2018. And then you look at it now and it doesn't quite seem to be this cohesive firing unit. So how do we make that happen?
Well, I think in answer to the question, does he have time, Gracia? Yes, no. I mean, he has... You know, he has 13 games, he has international break coming up, he has, you know, I guess the scope and the room there to make tweaks, to drill ideas constantly. And I guess the upside of the Premier League in comparison to the EFL is that you cut out the same number of midweek games that you have in the Championship. So you do have a little bit more time coaching the players than you would otherwise be blessed with in a lower division. Bear in mind as well that, you know, Bielsa's impact was absolutely spectacular in that summer. But one of the things you benefit from in the summer, and I wonder if this is why Bielsa much prefers and almost without fail has always gone into a club before the start of pre-season as opposed to mid-season. One of the things you have is the absence of pressure of results. Gracia is inheriting a team who have not been in the habit of winning this season, who don't know how to win often enough, and therefore have the kind of psychological baggage and pressure that goes with that, something that you just don't have in early August, and something actually that Marsh didn't have at the start of this season. You know, Leeds made pretty good progress in the first month, or certainly in the first few weeks through those games against Wolves, Southampton and Chelsea. But this is the business end, this is the sharp end, and this is when the mind plays tricks, and this is when the kind of old habits or the pressure that's been on for so long really starts to take effect and take hold. So Gracia can change the team, and I think we have seen him start to change it already. But I think what you can't have at this point of the season, what isn't possible, is a complete revolution of tactics and approach. It's just not feasible to do that at such a late stage.
Let's close out this show with a little indulgence then. We touched on it before, the 7-0 at Anfield, and there can't have been a Leeds fan in the known universe who didn't have a little chuckle at that. You know, it's always a nice reminder, isn't it, that even if you've had a bad week yourself, your team's lost, you can always find it within yourself to laugh at somebody else, even if they are far higher up the table. Because that, it just spiraled out of control, didn't it? And then I'm thinking specifically about like Bruno Fernandes wanting to know why he hadn't been taken off. I mean, have you ever seen anything like that before?
No, really strange, really strange. And to repeat what I said, I wonder if it's, I don't mean that a 7-0 defeat has been coming, because nobody ever has a 7-0 defeat coming, really. And you're right. I mean, the complete loss of control in that was staggering to watch. But I wonder if it's been the sort of reality check that's been in the post slightly. I think there's been quite a lot of title talk around Old Trafford because of the fact that Manchester United, little by little, have been closing in on City and Arsenal. Actually, the gap's opened up pretty dramatically again, and they're quite clearly not going to win it. But I don't think that on the evidence of what we've seen in the flesh, you know, the game at Old Trafford and then the game at Elland Road, and I accept that they were missing Casemiro for both of those. He was suspended. But I don't think that you felt like you were looking at a prime Premier League side there at all. They had top quality player in Rashford, you know, who was influential in both games. But in no way did I think that they were on a par with City at the best or Arsenal at the best. And I wonder whether, because they've been meandering as a club for a long time and suddenly have found some momentum under Erik ten Hag, I wonder whether people have just been a little bit blinded by what's actually happening and actually by some of the deficiencies that are in that side, which is not to say that they won't finish top four, because they definitely will. I don't know. The closest I can come to thinking of a game like that watching Leeds would be Hillsborough under Brian McDermott, the 6-0 defeat down there. I mean, they were kind of borderline heading for the worst defeat in Leeds history at that point, you know, heaviest defeat of all time. And it just felt as if the longer that went on, the more goals Sheffield Wednesday were going to score, because Leeds had gone completely. And I suppose there was also the heavy defeat that Bielsa's Leeds had over at Manchester City, another night when it just looked like goals were flowing for fun. So it does happen. and it's not pleasant. But yeah, you're right. I can imagine at the end of another fairly underwhelming weekend, there were a few Leeds fans who quite enjoyed that.
There'll be some people old enough to remember Leeds United playing Stoke City in the 1980s, Phil. I mean, I was around at that time, but I wasn't old enough to be going to that many away games at this point. But August 1985, went to Stoke and lost 6-2. And then season after, December 1986, you thought, well, it can't be that bad again. 7-2 season after.
We were doing, obviously, the football cliches show at the Carriage Walks in Leeds last week. And one of the things, I think this was your suggestion, actually, one of the things that the cliches mob had done at a previous show was to discuss the appropriate height at which you should clap the away end when you've been absolutely trounced. Because obviously you can't just disappear down the tunnel. You do, even if the away end are slating you and berating you, which they probably will be, you have to acknowledge the fact that they've turned up, and you have to acknowledge the fact that you've let them down badly. So you have to almost expose yourself to the poison by going over. But I was saying to them, you need to try and come up with a definitive answer for A, how close do you go to the away end so that you don't look like you're taking the mickey, but you also don't get so close that you can actually hear exactly what's being said. And also, do you clap above your head, or do you do that thing where you clap at waist height and look like you're thoroughly apologetic and it won't happen again? I didn't see what the Manchester United players were up to yesterday, but I bet that was fun and games with the few who'd stayed behind.
I do wonder if that's maybe just beyond the centre circle, waist height applause, yes, head bowed like a naughty dog that's been told off.
Yeah, it's waist height. You clap sort of 4 to 5 times in that way, which says, we're doing this because we have to do it, but we know that you don't want to see us, and we know that it means nothing to you. And absolutely, just beyond the centre circle is kind of safe ground. Any further than that, and it's getting a bit dicey.
And there you go. We finish on a nice sell for the Football Clichés podcast, also available from The Athletic. There we go. Phil Hayshaw will be back towards the back end of this week. You can sign up to read The Athletic, theathletic.com/LeedsPod. Speak to you at the back end of the week, Phil. We will preview the next game, Brighton at home.
Top man, Dan. See you then.
We'll see you soon.
The Phil Hayshaw.